Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musicians.
Kenny Holmes here with the great Robert Kraft and Matt Schrader. What's up, guys?
Hello.
Welcome to Score the Podcast.
Matt Schrader.
Big guest episode today. Excited to have him on. He's come across our emails and things for a long time, and I'm glad we're finally getting him on because I know he's a great storyteller, both musically and in interviews. He was an assistant of Michael Dana's for a long time before coming onto the scene on his own. He's got a movie on Netflix right now called Atlas, and he's also the composer of Mayor of Kingstown, which is back on Paramount Plus with the return of the incredible story of Jeremy Renner, which we'll get to as well. Andrew Lockington coming on the show.
Very
I'm
cool.
So happy to talk to him. I've loved Andrew's work for a long time. And much more important, I'm hoping that when we get to Atlas, he can give us some dish on J-Lo. I mean, what are we here for? Come
That's
on.
Right.
You know, we want the inside tip.
Another interesting theme that we have going on the last couple of weeks is another Canadian composer. And Robert, I think we had a little back and forth on social media about this, but we haven't talked about it on the show. But you're now, what's your official title with SOCAN, which is the organization behind Canadian composers? Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing with them?
My official title, and I would request that you are respectful of this title going forward, is I'm SOCAN's ambassador to Hollywood.
It hasn't gone to his head yet.
Which is just absolutely flattering. And I've been doing some composer workshops with SOCAN for the last couple of years and just overwhelmed by this incredible pool of Canadian talent. And you would think that in all my work here in the States, I'd know a lot of these composers. I started to say, I'm curious how I could maybe be helpful exposing them to a greater audience. And so they said, we were thinking the same. So I am working with a lot of really talented composers. Andrew Lockington is really right in the center of this conversation to start bringing the recognition of their work forward. And as you know, there's just a huge amount of production going on in Canada.
Yeah.
In Vancouver and Toronto. And sometimes American companies go to these provinces to shoot The Last of Us, Shogun, these huge productions, and then come running back to Hollywood to find a composer. I'm going to gently suggest that, as they would say, there are diamonds in your own backyard.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, we talk a lot about this in the show, but the fact that, you know, do you have to move to Hollywood to score a show or a movie? And that more and more is not the case with the technology that we have now. So it's really just a matter of those connections. I mean, the skill is there, the talent is there, but oftentimes that maybe network isn't available in that region, and you're kind of playing a part in that now, it seems like.
It's also interesting across a lot of the different art forms, but I have noticed this with composers as well, as Toronto especially, but Canada punches well above its weight. There's some really phenomenal artists that are coming from Canada. So it's very cool.
I mean,
and
so
shout out to Goggin Singh, friend of the show.
Oh, nice.
We know he
listens. Goggin's the man.
The SOCAN man.
Really responsible for introducing me to SOCAN initially. And Matt, I really appreciate that because SOCAN, strangely enough, really is important not only for composers and for film and TV, but can we talk about The Weeknd and Drake and Sarah McLachlan and, you know, huge Canadian artists. Oh, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell. I mean,
Bublé, right?
Yeah, Bublé. So,
I didn't know he was Canadian.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Brian Adams.
Avril. I mean, we could go forever on
this.
Yep.
So it's fun. It's really interesting for me and exciting. So I'm looking forward to it. Just started.
Very cool.
So we will.
That's
run.
Awesome. Well, yeah, between Chris Beck and Andrew Lockington, and yeah, there's a number of talent.
Michael Dana is a Canadian.
And Jeff.
Yep.
Not and surprisingly.
Yeah.
Parents, grew up on opposite sides of the border,
south of the 49th parallel.
Kenny, I know you were involved in a pretty cool concert that happened not too long ago here.
Yeah. Yeah. You may know his name, Bear McCreary. A really cool thing that we're seeing, and it was interesting when we were talking with Christoph Beck on the last episode, hearing him say that he wanted to forge into a new category and write his own album that wasn't related to a film.
Yep.
And yeah, I got a chance to work with Bear and his brother. So going back, way back, Bear's from the Pacific Northwest in like the breeding ground of iconic rock stars. I mean, Nirvana and, you know, the list goes on, Foo Fighters, all of those guys. But he, from the age of a teenager, had a dream of writing a rock album. And he finally pulled this together. He's been working on songs since some of the songs that he put on this solo album that he created he wrote them when he was 15 with his brother, and they had dreams of having a rock band together. And I even got a chance to chat with his mom about it. She was like, "This is so awesome." The concert was on Mother's Day of all days, so she got to see them do this. But yeah, they performed live at the Fonda Theater right in the heart of Hollywood. Bear's album, it's really cool because it kind of taps into...
Which is out, right? The whole album.
It's called The Singularity. It's a double disc. This isn't a commercial. Just it's but it's really
it's cool.
You should check it out. It ties into all the things that he's done as a film composer and also his rock influences. You have feature songs from Serj Tankian from System of a Down, Corey Taylor from Slipknot, Adru's Sierra from Ozo Motley, Slash does a big solo on the album. And these are all, Bear was telling me, he's like reaching out to people he admires the most with no sort of connections and just kind of hoping that they'll react and respond. And they did. And he's like over the moon about this album.
Love
but
that.
The experience live was awesome. I hope they do more of these concerts. I think he's doing one at Amoeba Records. He's living this rock star dream of like, you know, I'm sure every kid growing up wanted to play at Amoeba Records. That was probably one of those things on the list. But you should definitely check out the album, working alongside Bear and hearing the story. And also, I had no idea that his brother was a singer. I know that his wife sang on the Battlestar Galactica soundtrack, and she's also a part of the album too, but his brother is an incredible singer and performer. Oh my God, the energy that he was on the stage. It was awesome. And if they do more of these shows,
creative.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing about it was when we were talking, he really wanted to focus on doing something super unique. Like, yes, there's going to be people wanting to hear Outlander and all these things, but this is the Bear McCreary project, not someone's project that Bear McCreary's writing music for. So this is all his thing. He spent decades on this idea and this art, and he put it out there, and it's freaking awesome. You guys should definitely check it out.
And I mean, just from what I heard, I told Kenny when I heard just a little sample of something that you were working on for some of the video elements of that, but Bear's ear is just he's so good at what he does. And the rock sound, especially just being able to integrate that with like the whole kind of richness of what he does on film scores is just a really, really cool thing. He does it almost like nobody else can. So it's really cool sounding.
The mix of orchestral, and there's even a song with I think some of the singers from God of War, if I'm not mistaken. So there's some really unique tracks, and one of the tracks has a rapper on it. I mean, it's very much a mishmash of everything that Bear is and has become as an artist. But none of it is a film score track that he wrote for the screen. This is all his own thing. So it's really cool. A great thrill to work with him and his team on it, and Sparks and Shadows, all the guys over there. Really, really awesome. But I think it's maybe the new trend. I mean, you know, when we first started this show, the trend was
more and more.
Yeah, are composers gonna do a live version of their score? And now it's like, are composers itching to get out of their head whatever they've been living with that's not someone else's project that they're writing to, but doing their own thing? So,
well, it may be as simple as these composers reach a moment where making a bar of music without getting a note from someone else on it may mm-hmm. be a really attractive way to spend a day.
Yeah.
Where you yeah. can write music and not have somebody say, what is that a clarinet? Do we yeah. need to have a clarinet? You know, you might just want to say, I'm going to write music because
I was actually thinking maybe no music at all here.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that didn't work in the concert. When
believe me.
3 minutes of
it.
Silence.
I'm saying I love it. I mean, you can hear me saying I love it. It's not going in the movie, but I love it. I just want you to be clear.
There's also part of it, too, where, you know, the job of writing music for TV and film is in a dark room all the time, and you don't get that thrill of the immediate response
Absolutely.
Of playing in front of somebody, especially when it's something that's so personal to you, like writing yeah. a song when you're 15 and sitting on it until, you know, decades later. What a cool experience. But watching all those guys, Bear and his brother especially, it was really a thrill to see it firsthand and see the looks on their faces and having their mom in the crowd.
Oh, God.
It was awesome. But yeah, hopefully they do more of these concerts. I know
they're
that they
on
were
tour.
Throwing it
and,
around.
And but, more albums like this. How cool would it be to just have all these yeah. awesome composers that we talked to on this show and just actually expressing something that's fully theirs?
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah, really cool.
And being able to call up Slash doesn't hurt to add
yeah,
to
for
the
real.
Excitement. But yeah, check out the Singularity. Shout out to Bear and the Sparks and Shadows team. But let's get to it. Our guest this week, Andrew Lockington, Atlas, Mayor of Kingstown, and many more. Here's the episode.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're going to love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
All right, we're excited about our guest today. He has a big new movie out on Netflix called Atlas. He's also done a number of films with director Brad Peyton, including Rampage, San Andreas. Please welcome to the show composer Andrew Lockington. What's up, Andrew?
Hey, how are you guys? Great to see everyone.
Andrew.
And you guys go back, right, Robert?
Well, I actually tried to suss it out. Andrew, always good to see you. Your name's been around me recently, and I can explain why, but I did that really wild thing where I looked on IMDb. Sometimes you do that in show business, and you go scroll through your unbelievable credits, and I was trying to figure out what did I work on that Andrew was in the room and I got there. I wonder if you and I have the same picture in mind, because I remember you on Antoine Fisher with Denzel Washington. Am I even remotely correct?
That is probably where we met. Yeah, that was when I was working with Michael Dana.
Correct. And I thought, now in retrospect, I see, man, I was outnumbered by Canadians in that room. Because you, at that point, remind me, you were working with Michael. I don't know if you had moved fully to LA from Canada, or you were back and forth?
No, I was back and forth the same today. I've always been back and forth.
Ah, I didn't
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
Toronto is your...
Toronto.
Yeah. Good. Then I picked it correctly.
Is that where you are now?
It is where I am now.
All right.
And, you know, it's a bit controversial wearing that hat after losing in game seven of the playoffs for the eighth year in a row.
I'm fully aware. I read enough to know that Toronto was the, you know, your other home. But some of the work I've been doing in Canada, I make sure to get the right swag. So, and I've learned also, don't wear my Canadiens hat in Toronto.
Robert's wearing a Maple Leafs hat, if you're listening only, yes. Just so you're aware.
So you are actually the second person I admire to ever wear a Maple Leafs hat to an interview. The first being years ago, Chris Evans, Captain America, did a film, and he and I met. I did some music for that. I wasn't the composer, but I contributed some music to it. And at our first meeting, he showed up with a Maple Leafs hat on, which was incredibly impressive given he is a Bruins fan and there's not a lot of love lost between the Maple Leafs and the Bruins. So
I think it's more impressive that he's Captain America wearing a Canadian.
not for a Leafs fan.
Movie pitch, Captain Canada.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew, can you tell us just a bit? And then I know Kenny has a lot of great questions. Just a little bit about the background of how you, first of all, of course, what in Canada promoted the crazy idea of being a film composer, but what the process was like coming from Canada to the U.S. to start working with Michael Dana. I don't know.
The great Michael Dana, too. Wow, what a person to be working under.
Good place to start.
Yeah, I struck by lightning there in a good way. High school, wanted to be a rock star like so many of us. Was in a rock band, pop band. And everyone else was like 10 years my senior. So I was 15, traveling on the road, you know, during the week and trying to do my schoolwork, which I somehow managed to do. Probably good training for being a film composer, trying to multitask like that. And came to the last year, the band kind of fell apart and I applied for composition study in university. Didn't graduate. I'm a credit short of graduating.
Still.
And but upon finishing my 4 years or 3.9 years of studies, came to Toronto and did jingles for, you know, maybe 6 months. And all in that time, I really wanted to be a film composer. That was kind of my dream as a kid. That was always the music that fascinated me. And coincidentally, two members of the band prior to me, years prior to me, had been Michael Dana and Jeff Dana. Oh. So in mentioning to the bass player, oh, I really want to do this, he said, you know, you should really meet the Dana brothers. At that time, Michael was in Toronto, Jeff was in LA. So I made on a trip to LA and in Toronto, I met with both of them, among other composers, which is the path of so many of us. We kind of reach out and meet with our mentors and try to find the path. And shortly after I met with Michael, he reached out and said he had some projects and was looking for an assistant. And he was my mentor for probably 4 or 5 years.
Oh, that's great. And in those days, I mean, not that long ago, but was an assistant the code word for you're going to be plugging in MIDI instruments?
It was everything. Short of writing initially, it was everything. And then Michael was very generous and we co-wrote some projects together. I got my first credits alongside the great Michael Dana name. And that was really what gave me my foot in the door.
Was there a big team or was it just you and Michael at that time?
At that time, it was me and Michael. And Michael was sitting at his composing desk. I had a setup at my home, but I was often, I did everything from buying groceries to driving to the airport to everything. And that was my choice. I just said, I will do anything and everything. I want to be a fly on the wall. And it's amazing because through that process, I recorded in London, Seattle, LA, Utah, Toronto. I went with him everywhere. And I remember the first time I was at Abbey Road for my own film, The orchestrator conductor, Nicholas Dodd, who I'd gotten to know quite well through Michael, said, "Are you nervous? Hey, this is a big deal. Are you nervous?" And I thought, well, I've done this 20 times. I'd been in this situation in the chair to the right so many times that by the time I was in the chair on the left, it just I wasn't nervous. It felt like I had all the training I needed to do it.
It's so great.
I'm just curious, going back, so you're in a band, you're writing jingles, but film scoring has a lot more to it. Was there some schooling in between there, or did you learn on the fly, or like, what's your training in terms of orchestration and all of these things that go into scoring a movie like Atlas?
So the orchestration understanding I studied in university.
Okay.
And I'd say I learned more about orchestration singing in the choirs. Wow. Than I did studying orchestration. Because when you're singing, I was singing baritone or bass, and when you're singing these lines, you realize that you have this melody that is part of chords, but it's actually a melody in and of itself.
Love that.
And it's so important to learn that in terms of writing for an orchestra. So yeah, that was my orchestration and arrangement and composition was something I studied in university. My understanding of film scoring really came from Michael and also Jeff on the side. Like, I learned so much. The School of Dana. Oh, it was like about coming up with themes and figuring out the evolution and all the subconscious ways of putting these themes into the score so that your audience absorbs it subconsciously but isn't aware of hearing the same thing over and over. That was all picked up from them, and then trial and error after them.
How would you describe your time with Michael? Like, if someone said, elevator pitch me on what Michael Dana is like working with as a composer.
He is a very cerebral person in his thought and how he thinks of music. It's much more than just motifs and licks. Mm. He thinks of the big picture and themes and character and much more than just, you know, and I think this is everyone nowadays, but much more than just throwing music behind a scene that makes you feel one thing. It's about scoring a story from 30,000 feet and what can the music do to tell a parallel story. And really hard work. I worked really hard, and that was good training. Like, you look at the schedule and you think, there's no possible way I can get this done in the time I have. But you learn to just put your head down and chip away at it and divide your task into the number of days you have to do it. And every day ends up feeling like the night before the essay is due. But you get there. You kind of look back and go, wow, look how far we came.
Probably why you weren't nervous.
I really love your description of Michael being cerebral. You're absolutely spot on. And also that he showed you the 30,000 foot view. It makes me think how much I spend time trying to explain to people that composers are most often the good ones, intellectuals, artists. They happen to have, instead of words or paint, they're using eighth notes. But this isn't exactly what you said. This isn't sort of jamming some music behind an action. It's a very thoughtful process at the highest levels. And the composers that I know, yourself included, are just these, they are rock stars. That's the irony. You became a rock star. And it's just such a privilege to be able to hear from composers. And needless to say, we didn't have the opportunity to experience you as the solo composer. When and what film was that, you know, you had to leave the nest?
That's a good question. It was gradual. It was little things. And then I think Antoine Fisher was the last project I did with Michael. Actually, it was at that point where I was too busy. He was making the move to LA around that time, full time. Mm. He'd been going back and forth. And then I did a couple of projects. I remember I did a couple of things for HBO that were sort of straddling the line between quote unquote TV movie and movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then It's funny. I was just talking about this the other day. We had the 20th anniversary of this film, Touch of Pink, that I did 20 years ago. Kyle MacLachlan. It's sort of a romantic comedy with a an homage to the 60s Doris Day, Rock Hudson bedroom comedies.
Nice.
And I was saying to my wife, you know, I remember that somebody saw this film and then someone saw that film. And it, and you kind of follow the bouncing ball. And it was maybe two films later that I was sitting with New Line Cinema having a meeting about a journey to the center of the earth with Brendan Fraser, which was really my big break, my first big studio film on my own. And that was sort of the beginning of the journey.
That's amazing. I wonder, I should know, it's like Elmer Bernstein or Jerry Goldsmith, or who scored the one that I saw when I was, you know, 6 years old. And did you listen? It's not a quiz question. It's just an interesting, you know, I just read about a number of films that are currently out there. And I wonder, does, for example, on Ripley, you know, do the actors and
Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, good call. How great. Well, you weren't stepping into very big shoes.
No, and, you know, thank God I didn't listen to it, because I would have probably shied away and just done the we're not worthy Wayne's World move. But
more Canadians.
More Canadians, that's right. Same city.
Yep.
When you went to that first big studio film, what was your biggest takeaway or difference? Do you remember, like feeling this is a studio film now? Is it just more people involved? What was the biggest overwhelming thing that you noticed?
It's a great question. There's two things. One is, yeah, there's more people involved. There's higher stakes. There's more money put into it. So if this film bombs, the executives' positions are a little more tenuous. So there's quite a bit more at stake for everybody. The other side is creatively, it's exactly the same. Your process is exactly the same. You have slightly different resources, hopefully more resources, but that's not always a good thing. You know, I remember a lot of times going, oh, okay, I'd love to record this, but I can't. Then you end up having to come up with a MacGyver solution that is often better, that maybe you wouldn't have chosen, that if you'd had a massive, you know, 10-day orchestra budget, you might not have chosen this really unique idea that ends up being perfect for the film. So, but more and more, you know, I think all film, like, our job is the same regardless of the budget and what we're doing. It's the task is the same. The way you're breaking it down is the same. And the projects you do for free, essentially, are just as much work as the projects you get paid for.
Is there a better sense of, I don't want to say, what do you prefer, indie or big budget, but as an artist, is the indie approach a little more satisfying, do you think, when you have that freedom to not have to answer to so many people?
Hasn't been my experience. I'm lucky in that the big studio, like films like Atlas, are with, like, it's my eighth project with Brad. So there's a trust there that I can take the big swings and try something unique. And if the spaghetti doesn't stick to the wall, that's okay. It's not a first experience with a director where you worry that, oh, they'll, you know, they might lose confidence. I actually really like going back and forth between the different genres and the different types of film, something more kinetic like Atlas, something more cerebral like The Kindness of Strangers that I did for Lona Scherfig a few years ago. And it's, I you know, probably the worst thing is having someone come to you, like did happen to me a few times, and say, oh, I love this film, we've temped it with your score, we want you to do something exactly like this. And suddenly your hands are tied, because all the process of experimenting and looking from 30,000 feet and coming up with a unique approach is handcuffed. So
I had a big conversation this morning, actually, before we started, with one of your esteemed colleagues, strangely enough, talking about AI and temp scores. And the takeaway was, there should be no temp scores. Why are we even talking about AI? Because the flip side of that conversation And every composer feels it, you know. So I'm supposed to beat a score that I wrote 2 years ago that you guys love, but I'm not there emotionally. The film isn't there emotionally. Or, so you've tempted with John Williams, and now I'm to come in, and you're in love with that vibe. And I'm going to match a Star Wars cue for this end title. And the takeaway in our conversation was, no temp score is not an easy place to go. It seems to me, though, that coming back to the indie versus big studio film, it's really so often about the director and, you know, whether it's a freebie for you or a monster, and how, you know, there can be problems on each, but how fortunate you are to have a relationship with one director. That's in many ways.
I have a question for both of you guys.
Yeah.
This might be something both of you can answer, but if the feeling of temp scores seems to be the same for everyone, like I'd rather come in with a clean slate, and you're the creative that's doing the music, why do they even put temp music in if it hinders your ability to be more creative? If that's the feel, it seems like it's the feeling amongst everyone. I get that they have to put the picture together and get some feels for it, but ultimately the composer's going to come in and write music. So why wouldn't the composers all band together and just say, why don't we just try stop doing this? It just seems like...
I defer to the maestro.
Well, you'll have a different take on this potentially, but I think there are benefits to temp music, actually. I've been on projects where they said, we don't want any temp music. We want the score like this. And, you know, the 18 approaches that they want to try to picture, if you have to write 18 things, you're pretty stale by the 19th. So in some ways, throwing other ideas against picture that hopefully won't live there for 6 months and all the test screenings and all the various director's cut, producer's cut, and have people get so married to it. But if it's kind of coming up with an approach, I think that can be helpful. I've done, you know, maybe half the things I do now, ironically, we don't temp. I just start writing suites and writing ideas, and then the ideas end up in the edit suite and they start temping with it. And 9 times out of 10, that's an amazing process for me. But on 1 out of 10, you end up just kind of trying 15 different approaches. And those are the ones I wish we'd had a temp score or some temp ideas to kind of figure out the palette that works.
I really love that answer. And also your question, Kenny, because you bracketed a couple things. First of all, you said, kind of at the end, almost as a throwaway, well, I know they have to put the picture together. That's so huge. These guys have to show studio execs some kind of assembly that says, and in this part, we got this James Newton Howard cue. You know, they don't say that, but we found a cue in, you know, of some runaway train scene and whatever
gotta
that
sell
movie
it.
Was. Right. Yep. So they're selling that, and they're playing that for the composer. We love that. Andrew, you said something really interesting, which I had the good fortune to watch evolve in the film scoring process, which was, I think when I first started getting focused, you know, growing out of being in a rock band, getting really interested in film music, it was cuey, one of my favorite words, that you spotted the film and you wrote the cue for that scene and you moved ahead and you bounce around, but, oh, maybe I can use this theme, you know, in reel 6. But you just used a word that did not come to America until a couple composers, I really felt, brought it from Europe, writing suites prior to the film. And I saw it happen with anywhere from Jan Kaczmarek, may he rest in peace. He would show up, Polish composer, with these beautiful pieces of music. He even would record them the very first day of scoring instead of scoring the picture. He would do orchestral, big, 8-minute cues, and then the editors would cut it in. I also saw it with David Fincher taking... And he does it with Trent and Atticus, and he did it with the Dust Brothers on Fight Club. He just would take, like, I always felt it was like yards of music that they would give him.
just fit it in there somehow.
And just say, this is the vibe, I'll fit it in. So the sweets thing is relatively recent, I think. Though maybe I was unaware of it before, but...
I've heard of it. I know Hans famously has sweets.
Hans was really the popularizer of it.
Yeah. Ironically, I call it sweets. I actually, the word I use in my studio is sketches. So I'll actually do 90-second to 3-minute little versions and variations on different themes. And I'll give the editors, here's 4 variations on this theme. This is what I think this theme represents. And then they'll temp it in, and they have different incarnations of that they can use. And most of the time, it's actually done, there's a communication there with the editorial that works really well. And sometimes they come back with something in the wrong place, and that's fine. And sometimes they come back with something in the wrong place that's amazing. Oh, wow, I've never thought of that. Totally make this connection now, and this totally makes sense. And so it's worked well. And to be honest, when I work with, so I do 3 shows with Taylor Sheridan and that whole universe.
Yeah.
And that's what we do. You know, I'll write things. I'll actually record things often where he's approved the theme, but I'll then go away and go to Abbey Road and do 4 or 5 variations on it, give it to the editors, and then it starts getting temped in. And it's by no means final. I end up obviously scoring ultimately and changing things and using different variations of the themes that have been temped, and the temp changes, but it kind of gets us halfway there. And the amazing thing is people internalize these themes in the way that the John Williams or the James Horner temp that the studio loves. They love it because it's amazing music, don't get me wrong. But one of the reasons why they end up using those cues is because they've heard it for 10 years and it scored their life. It scored this emotional thread in their life. So when they hear it in their film, there's so much more history to it than just being in that scene. And that's what you're trying to compete with as a film composer. And that's what makes temp so hard, is that you're competing with their history with that music, not hearing it for the first time the way they are hearing your thing for the first time.
The nostalgia of it, yeah. Does Brad Peyton, you've worked with him on so many projects now, and that trust and that second hand is there. Do you temp with him, or does he just hand you a empty slate like that?
It's actually a different process with Brad. So Bob Doucet, picture editor that we've worked with the last 3 films, amazing picture editor. And he's one of those editors that he's editing the sound and the picture at the same time. They're both equally important to him. All of his temp tracks are all in 5-1. That's so rare. All the sound, the music, everything's in 5-1. And he comes to it. He puts in with Brad these ideas. Sometimes they're sketches I've given them. Sometimes they're temp. From other things, but the 3 of us kind of end up crafting and evolving the sound together. And a lot of times, even the temp that's chosen, Joe Bond, music editor we worked with, also a genius, he works with Bob all the time. And a lot of times the sound that Brad and I will have come up with in the sketches, that then gets mined in other scores where we'll get this homogenous temp soundtrack, but the anchor of that might have been an idea that I wrote or something I came up with. So then they're going off and finding those elements that will be sympathetic with that.
You Very said something that really I've never thought of, which is the connection that directors have to the temp score. I thought, or to certain emotional beats that come from a picture music combination that gives them this emotional memory. It's almost, I don't know why I've never thought of this after 912,000 experiences. It's like dropping the needle on a favorite song. You put a Neil Young song in a movie that you know and love that song, and it gives you this feeling. I never thought temp score can do that for a director. He's just dropping the needle on a piece of music that gives him a feeling. I want to ask a question about something you just mentioned in passing, in our very first conversation about the Toronto Maple Leafs, and you said you know, you've scored everywhere. L.A., Abbey Road, Utah. And then at the very end of the sentence, you said Toronto. Do you score in Toronto? Is there scoring in Toronto? Do you have feelings about Toronto as a destination for all the films that are made?
You know, the biggest disadvantage in Toronto, because the musicianship's amazing, and and the diversity of musicians from all over the world. Toronto is such a kaleidoscope of culture, and so music is also represented in that. And I can record, you know, a gamelan player, you know, today if I pick up the phone. It's amazing. You can access, much like LA. LA's like that a lot too. Studios, they're just, we don't have the sound stages or the rooms here to really benefit to really let the musicians thrive in the way they would in LA or London. So that's the biggest disadvantage. I have had a lot of success with smaller groups recording in some churches, and that's pretty film school indie approach. I actually had a 4-hour session in a church years ago, and we had to turn the heat off in the church because it was so loud, and it was the middle of winter, freezing cold. So we had to turn the heat off. And about 15 minutes in, all the players put on their puffy Canada Goose jackets as they're sitting there playing. And then we took a break, and I realized there was this white noise with the jackets rubbing against each other on all the string parts.
ASMR.
And I thought, okay, we need to turn the heat back on for a few minutes, and then we get everyone take their jacket. It was amazing how difficult it was. We're all running around moving chairs, finding the squeaky chairs. And we ended up mixing it at Abbey Road, even though it was recorded in this, you know, in such a indie way. And Andrew Dudman, the engineer, said, "Wow, this sounds amazing. Where'd you record this?" So somehow we pulled it off. But which tells me it can be done, but it definitely was a lot more complicated than sitting at Air or Abbey or Fox.
Well, Air, it's interesting you mentioned Air. Here I'm thinking Air was a church. And so
exactly.
They did a little work in there, though, I think.
And there was Media Studios in Manhattan where we did a lot of recording. It was a beautiful church, but it had been really repurposed. Mm-hmm. And you solved something for me. And I think the hardest part of this may be not an obstacle, which is the players. So if the players are there, if you build it,
I was just gonna say it, didn't want to be too cheesy,
Kenny, but yeah, you wanted to it. Before we you wanted to ask about some specific films, I know, particularly the big one that's out right now.
I have a question about Atlas and maybe on a bigger picture working with Brad. It seems like Brad he loves these big worlds. He particularly loves blowing up cities in the United States. but I'm curious, as a composer, when you know all of this action is machine guns, explosions, booms and bangs coming in, does that affect your musical choices in terms of frequencies and interference with the mixing of all of these sound effects? Because there is so much going on audio-wise in these films, and I'm just wondering if that's on your radar.
Oh, it's front and center. It is. I think that's why scoring for picture is very different than scoring for audio. It's a very different experience. And I'll listen to scores that I've done, the soundtracks, and I can appreciate it, but I also feel like it's missing the visual component that was the other half. So I'm really lucky with Brad's films. He works with a sound supervisor, Per Hallberg, in LA, who is a dear friend, and we really like spending time together. We will put our heads together every 2 weeks. We sit down, we either on Zoom or on the phone or in a room, and I play him what I've done, and he's playing me what he's done. We have choreographed the entire soundscape of the film by the time we get to the mix stage. There's no question marks. He has repitched the squeal to be in sync with the key that I wrote the cue in.
Love
and
that.
And I have written this section in woodwinds and avoided any low end because I know what he's doing. And so it's a very successful dance, especially with him. But I make that a point with all the projects I work on to really get in touch with the sound design and make sure that you're not going to end up at the mix stage with, you know, two things at 50%, two faders. That's the worst thing. Music 50%, sound effects 50%. Instead, find who's leading, and then the other person can support them, and vice versa.
It's so generous because I'm so used to it being, you described it perfectly, sound effects at 88. you know, I think the orchestra, you know, you've recorded a 100-piece orchestra at Abbey Road, and they are down in the minimal department because we got to hear the helicopters and the bombs. But I love that you've kind of at least thought about it with the sound guy. It's so nice.
Well, so, you know, one of my pet peeves is the orchestra playing a fortissimo and them drop down to one on the volume knob. That's the worst sound to me. So if you know they're going to be at a one, have them play it quietly and figure all those dynamics out before you get to recording, because there's nothing worse than an orchestra just going to town and being super, super quiet. To me, that's in my circumstance, that's a lack of communication. So I'm trying to avoid those.
That's just great. Can I ask how you met and where you met Brad?
Yeah, so I, that film, Journey to the Center of the Earth, one of the first big things I did. Mm-hmm. Actually, I guess I did a Lionsgate horror film, Skinwalkers, prior to that. Mm. But Journey, Brad was brought on to direct the second Journey film, and they swapped out Brendan Fraser for Dwayne Johnson. Mm. And there were, I think Josh Hutcherson was the only returning character. Yeah. And it was really a brand new team. And I was asked to come in and meet with Brad. And there was some question whether Brad would want to hire me. And because he had sort of put together his own workers, his own team, and bringing them to the second film.
Right.
And our first meeting, he sat down. He said, I really love the theme from the first movie. I love the score. But what would you do differently? How could you update it? What would you do to bring it? Take it to another level for the second film. So I told him in theory what I was thinking, and he said, okay, show me some examples. So I went away and started sketching ideas and would come back every few days and he'd give notes. And pretty soon I'd spent 2 months in this process and I thought, this is great. I'm working on this film. And I fully had assumed for the last six weeks of that 8 weeks that I was hired and here we go. And my agent, Robert Messenger, called me up and said, good news, they want to hire you. And I thought, I've just been working for 2 months solid. I assumed I was hired. I didn't realize how tenuous it was. But thank God, we didn't miss a beat. We just sort of got going, and that was the beginning of a long relationship.
That's
now,
the best.
For an aspiring composer, is that period paid when you're demoing for that long, or is that just a constant job interview that you're hoping they bite?
Yeah, no, it's not paid. It's, you just, you know, it's part of, and sometimes it's part of the process. You have to kind of come with ideas and say, this is what I'm thinking, and audio examples. And I think that, I mean, Robert, you'd know more than me, but I think that's more common these days too, when you're pitching to be a composer, that you've done something bespoke as opposed to just saying, here's five things from my repertoire.
Oh, like they
like
love
a
that.
Spec sketch.
Yeah.
As opposed
they love
to
it. It's a big issue as to how many, I mean, the 6 weeks thing in the future. I think that a lot of composers may have something to say about how much freebie you do. I mean, certainly the Writers Guild wouldn't let you write 6 weeks of scripts
for sure
without a deal.
Yeah.
But I think composers are used to that. And certainly for you, it's the wise choices. I'm going to audition until I get the gig. There's, you know, what's consider the alternative, as they say. Okay, you didn't get the gig. And, well, hey, man, but I wrote some music for a little while, and that doesn't sell as well as I hung in there.
Well, this it probably sounds more noble than it was. I honestly thought I'd been hired 6 weeks
so
prior.
Funny.
So I,
so funny.
I had I known it was still tenuous, I hope, I like to think I would have hung in there, and obviously it would have paid dividends if I had still.
It's so funny. I digress, but last night I heard Michael McDonald speak. He has a new book out, you know, about Steely Dan, the Doobie Brothers, and all that. And he said his first Steely Dan audition, he went with his Wurlitzer piano and was very accustomed to, after 15 minutes, they say, thanks very much. And it went an hour, and then 2 hours and 3 hours. He had no idea if he had the gig, and then everybody sort of packed up and he left, just like you. And then the next call was like, you know, we're leaving for tour on Sunday, so just be at the airport. Nobody ever officially hired him. And so it was similar, that he didn't know, really, did he have the gig? It wasn't 6 weeks, but he said that was them. They were never direct or overt. They just said...
Don't post it on social media until it comes out.
Oh,
right?
Shoot. Yeah. You have an active social media account, Andrew, that you talk about all your projects?
I'm on Instagram, and I would have thought I had a lot of followers till I had a teenage daughter, and now I realize I'm pretty irrelevant, to be honest.
Join the club.
Yeah, I'll post things occasionally on there when I'm doing something I'm excited about.
Yeah, there's certain things, though, you can't, you know. I wonder if people are surfing your site to see if you can bring us up to date on J-Lo and Ben.
Hey, Robert, we had this discussion. This isn't the show for...
I'm not saying I'm interested. I'm not saying this is our audience is interested. I'm just saying, do people say, wait a minute, let's find the composer of her last film? My guess is they don't. But
not today.
You also have an Argo credit, too, so there's some kind of connection here. You're I don't know what's going on.
I will say this, just on the subject of Jennifer.
News break.
I obviously a fan of hers. You know, anyone who has a music career where they can condense it into their greatest hits into a Super Bowl halftime show is an idol of mine for sure. She's an amazing human being. I was so blown away by her creativity and her work ethic on this project, and I can't imagine what it would be like to be under that kind of microscope in your life. But for her to endure all the media that she does, and all the rumors and everything that happens, and still come to work and work as hard as she does every day, this is not a paid advertisement. I am truly blown away at how talented she is, and my experience with her was 10 out of 10.
I love hearing that. Love
it. Was she involved in the music at all in this?
She was involved in everything. Like she wasn't a producer by title. She was at the screenings. She was sitting in the edit room. She was giving comments on music. She was very involved. So yeah, it's a real credit. It's a real experience.
It's fantastic to hear it. It is academic that you don't get to be a star of that caliber without working really hard. You know, luck only takes you so far, but you don't get to be J-Lo without, I mean, not only dancing, singing, acting, all that, but it's wonderful to be reminded she puts in the work. And it's just, I love hearing that. And it's probably going to be the most famous clip of this entire interview because you're talking, and if you want your Instagram to blow up, you know, wait, you know J-Lo? So isn't that funny? Because we're in that kind of world.
So I watched the film, Atlas. It kind of, her dynamic with Smith, the robot companion, it kind of reminded me of Knight Rider a little bit. A little bit more sarcastic.
Yeah.
But the back and forth where the robot is always very monotone and serious, and she's, what do you mean? We can't, you know, bringing them into dangerous situations. So check it out. It's a fun watch. There's a scene where she's in the robot suit and they're falling through the sky. And it made me think, because action movies like this, there could truly be music from second to second the entire film. But there is a scene where they're falling and there's no music for quite a lot of time. And then you chose to bring music in. And I'm curious, you've done all different types of genres of movies. How is the spotting different in an action movie for you? Because you really could put music anywhere, but how do you make those decisions? It feels like it could be challenging to put them in the right spot.
So it's interesting you mentioned that scene, because that scene, there were many incarnations where it was just sound effects, just music, and then sort of a mosaic of both. And that's a perfect example of working with Pear and with Bob and with Brad, where Pear, I played the music scene of that, where I had no music in the initial part, and then when she comes through the clouds, the music came in on the battle. And then Pear said to me, you know, I love the music. This 25 seconds, the sound effects need to tell this story. They need to tell about this malfunction. They need to tell about this. And he described this choreography of what he was doing in the sound effects. And I realized I was just being kinetic. I wasn't being emotional in any way. I was adding to the chaos in the music. And he had that handled. And all I was doing was obscuring what he was doing. So that was that's a great example of how our bi-weekly meetings and talking totally shaped. And I was like, hey, I'm great to step out here for this section. And then I said, but I really want to come in here when she's winning for a minute, because that's where I can tell the story. So the broader question about spotting in action films in general, it really comes down to sound effects and also kinetic versus more pensive and emotional and cerebral. And I'm always, my first gut is always for the music to try to do the opposite of what you see, especially in a film like this, where if you've got this rhythm and all this kinetic movement and this banging and this ta-ta-ta-ta-ta in the sound effects, the last thing you need is the strings going ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. So, and inversely, I think there can be real action moments where the music can have this long line stakes. What's at stake here? One reference that I think of a lot in films, and it's not for what John Williams did, but it's simply for the spotting, is Saving Private Ryan. I can't tell you for sure, but I'm quite certain there's no music when they're storming the beach in Normandy. There's none. And the music comes in the contemplation and the realization and the shock of what they did after. And I think that's a genius spotting on their part, because it separates the moment of kinetic and reflection, of action and reflection. And I think of that a lot in films like this, where the music's job is to tell you the stakes before the action moment. And then in the action moment, there's no emotional thought or contemplation of what this means. It's a, you know, a fight or flight moment. So if the music isn't supporting that fight or flight feel, then it's just getting in the way.
Hey, young composers, you just got a graduate level.
Yeah, the Lockington School
master's
of spotting.
PhD level. In fact, the entire conversation, Andrew, was, I mean, from how you got started and the gig, and you made the effort to come to LA, and there's so much here that is instructive for anybody that wants to get even close to the rooms that you are in.
You need to put a caveat at the bottom of everything I've said and said, this will work 50% of the time.
All the time.
I like 50. Yeah. That's ambitious.
Yeah.
50% of the time, all the time.
Right. 50% of the time, all the time. That's, I think the perfect analogy is, however, what Wayne Gretzky said. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So you gotta go for it. You gotta have those conversations with the music. Hey, I could do something here. I could lay out. Let's talk about it. I really think it's wonderful to hear how much contemporary composers are filmmakers too, that you are in there. You're not phoning in music or showing up at the mix with, here's Mike. You're talking to the sound guys.
Yeah, I like
you also
that.
Are blessed with a director that isn't, and I say this gently, an expert in everything and allows you to experiment. I mean, I'm sure he's an expert in everything, but you have to have this community around you that's going to offer you ideas, and the fact that you're working
with level of trust, right?
They got to, I think it's great.
Open the door for you.
I've had conversations with directors who sometimes, you know, all of us, we hate when someone throws a 180-degree idea at us when we already were set in stone that this is what it should be. And I've said to directors in the past, usually to mediocre reception, lukewarm reception, that if I do exactly what you want, you don't need me. If I if I'm not bringing ideas to the table that you haven't thought of, or things that, if we're not trying something different than what's in your mind, then you could put this score together yourself. So I say it in a much more diplomatic way than it just came off.
That was pretty diplomatic.
But I mean, I mean it. That's part of your role is to say, I take your creative vision and I recommend these tools to reflect it.
Not all directors are entirely comfortable hearing that, particularly if they've started your relationship with saying, I just want you to know, I played trumpet in my high school band, so right. You know, I know music. And I had a lot of those, and you'd think, this is going to be a long picture.
Those are the hardest ones. It's the people, I mean, I find this with musicians too, when they say, oh, I kind of play a bit, means they're really good.
Oh, I love
and when
that.
They say they're really good, you go, oh, I'm not so sure, we'll see. So yeah, it's interesting. The one thing I will say, and I don't know if this is your experience, but someone asked me recently, when did you know you made it? When did you know you'd mastered? And I think that my confidence level, and maybe this is true of everybody, is inversely proportional to the length of my IMDb credits. I think everything I do, I have to make sure. I'm more insecure about it, making sure it's great, than I was when I started out. And I think that you have to be your own worst critic, and you have to make sure that, you know, there's no good enough. You have to try to make sure that when you're sitting with a 100-piece orchestra, that you left no stone unturned. You didn't go, I'm tired, I'm going to bed 3 weeks earlier. You just, you know, it's the pressure's always there. And back to J-Lo and all of those people, I think the same is probably true of them. Like there's their standard of everything they do gets higher and higher, and they have to try to top that each time.
Well, you've just nailed it. I mean, the minute any one of us think, oh, I've made it in this business, maybe in roofing, I've made it, I'm getting a lot of gigs putting roofs on, you know, finally, in this business. If you say that, your career's over.
Yeah.
I've made it. Yeah. Oh, no.
Never stop learning.
Yeah, too. I'm going to go for something more. I'm going to be risky, because our lives are about being vulnerable and adventurous. And the minute you've made it and...
Before we wrap up, Andrew, I wanted to ask you just about future projects. Is there anything that you can share that is coming up?
Yeah. So Mayor of Kingstown season 3, one of the projects I do with Taylor.
Yep.
That'll be out
June 2nd.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's great. I didn't know it was that soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's Jeremy's first thing coming back from that. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that. Just being on the inside, I actually grew up in Reno, so yeah. It was a big local story for my family and friends. But Jeremy Renner obviously went through that snowcat accident, and unbelievably, a year after that was on set, I think, recording the next season, which is filming the next season, which is insane. But what was that like for you guys on the crew behind the scenes? I mean, that must have been... The only other example I can think of is like when Bob Odenkirk had a heart attack mid Better Call Saul season, where like the star of the show is severely affected by something.
Taylor's universe is a pretty tight-knit family. There's a lot of people that are associated with many of his projects. And obviously, you know, show aside, as anyone, we were first and foremost terrified for our friend Jeremy. So he had finished filming the second season at that point, or I may have been wrapped. I can't remember, but, once when he started to recover, and I think the process of filming season 3 probably chronicles a lot of his recovery.
Mm.
I think, you know, he said actually recently in an interview that when he started filming, he was exhausted trying to get through the scenes and the days. And everyone else is exhausted, having just finished filming a few weeks ago. And he's empowered and ready and feels like this was his therapy, physical therapy. So I'm so happy. He obviously he's okay. And it's so much fun to work with him. He's such an amazing actor, and that character and that world is so much fun to score that I'm really glad I got an opportunity to continue that storyline.
Well, listen, I mean,
killing it.
Yeah, you are. And I think the most dangerous part of this conversation is any composer that listens is going to say, man, that gig sounds fun.
It is fun. You can hear when people do that.
It sounds fun to me what you're doing. Yeah. It sounds great. And no, you got to tell somebody who's coming up, man, you don't. Abbey Road isn't that cool. And hanging with J-Lo, it's overrated. You know, what do you say to them? These are the peak experiences of life. And it's just so great, Andrew, that you're getting to do it. It's a long way from seeing you getting the coffee in the back of the Fox stage while we're doing Antoine Fisher.
Well, that was fun too, though. I got to say, all the stops along the way have been equally as enjoyable.
Oh, that's so.
Well, let's try to get your following. What's your Instagram handle? We'll see if we can get some more people on there.
Oh yeah, another one or two would go a long ways.
That's what we do best. One or two is all we promise.
At Andrew Lockington Music.
Perfect. And a reminder to our listeners,
please tune in. You can subscribe. That's my pitch.
And a reminder to our listeners, you can follow our show a number of ways on X and TikTok is at Score the Podcast, Instagram at Score Movie. Facebook, Score, a film music documentary, and you can watch these episodes on our YouTube channel, Epic Left Media, or if you're on Spotify, these are video episodes along with audio. So a number of ways to take this all in. Andrew Lockington, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. What a fantastic conversation about approaches and backstory and never giving up.
Awesome. Thanks.